Republicans choose Donald Trump again.
I'm thrilled to be back in Wisconsin.
Democrats select Joe Biden again.
It's going to help us again get over this hump and really bring this community together.
And the rematch is set.
You know, we won this state. We won this state by a lot.
This week on Open Record, changes in the state constitution, down ballot drama in Milwaukee, and the race for the White House is on. From the Fox 6 studios, this is Open Record. I'm Brian Polson, and I'm joined by Open Record's executive producer, Sarah Smith, back in her rightful chair.
Hello.
Welcome back, Sarah.
Hello.
And we are joined once again by Fox 6 political reporter, Jason Calvey. Hey, Jason.
Hey, guys.
Jason just here, like a few short hours ago with me. Sarah was across the way, but we are all back in our seats once again. We are recording this episode on Wednesday, April 3rd, for release on Thursday, April 4th. And as we record, the dust is only beginning to settle on the late night drama behind a $252 million tax increase for Milwaukee schools. We have presidential primary results and comments to parse through and a whole slew of local races and other school referendums and other things to talk about. We're going to get started on all of that right after this. So we went 2.5 hours live streaming from this very desk on Tuesday
night.
Brand
new desk.
Brand
might
new
I
desk
say.
That will be used also for the Republican National Convention. So we're getting to break it in a little bit. But we were here doing that all of last night. So as we record this Wednesday morning. But by the time we were done at 9 p.m., the votes had not even been reported in Milwaukee. We had zero votes on the MPS referendum. Shortly after we left this digital studio, those numbers started coming in. And for a while, there were 99% of precincts reporting, and there was just this, I mean, it was on a razor's edge.
So little, yeah.
It was, the no votes had it by about 200, looked like it might go down, but it was really close, and it all depended on those absentee ballots, and sure enough, when absentee ballots came in, they swung this thing pretty significantly toward the yeses, a 1,700 vote margin. So it's a big victory for supporters of the MPS referendum, right, Jason?
That's right. They had pushed for this. It really was introduced around Christmas time and then started approving it, got it on the ballot this year, 2024. And there was both sides this time around. You remember the last referendum was in 2020 for MPS, Milwaukee Public Schools. This time, around 4 years later, there was organized opposition. There were two different groups that had mailers and campaign ads, and in both sides, the yes side and the no side, both were on television and really trying to get people to be swayed one way or the other on this particular issue. It is going to raise those taxes across Milwaukee and the city of Milwaukee. $252 million every year moving forward. It ramps up over the course of 4 years to that 252, but then after that, $252 million will be on the books pretty much for the future.
Indefinitely for the future.
Yeah.
It's $250 million. This is not a small amount of money, but obviously for supporters of this, they say that's just how short the state was leaving them in terms of revenue limits and things like that. So tell us what's going to happen with this money. Do we know where this money's going to go? I know that was a point of contention for some of the opponents, is that there's not a lot of transparency over what's going to happen.
I think the opponents were also upset about the timeline, as far as that they felt like there wasn't enough time to have a robust discussion about the plans for this money. And they said, at least, you know, the Greater Milwaukee Committee, which is made up of nonprofits, educational leaders, and business leaders in the Milwaukee area, they came out opposed to this referendum because they said there wasn't enough transparency on where the money was going to be spent, and just the background of that time span of not having enough time to really debate it, discuss it, even potentially like getting together, they said, to make a pitch to Madison to send more money, because they said, yeah, Milwaukee needs more money for the schools, but maybe there could be a concerted effort to lobby like the community did for the sales tax, when they had to go lobby lawmakers in Madison to get approval for Milwaukee City to install the state's first city sales tax. So those were the oppositions. Now, as far as the opponents, as far as what's going to happen with the money, MPS has discussed this in January at a budget meeting, and a lot of the money is going to go, $92 million, I think, is going to go to continue to keep on board some of these specialty teachers. They after the 2020 referendum in Milwaukee, they hired art teachers and music teachers in schools across the district. And so this money will help keep those people on board. That's what MPS says. And it will also give, I think, about 20% of this $92 million I just mentioned will be spent on raising salaries for teachers, giving a pay raise to the teachers and staff and everybody else that works at MPS.
Well, and some of the voters that we talked with, both you know, ahead of the election and right after they had voted, it sounded like they were torn. You know, maybe we didn't know which way they had voted, but they kind of said, we want the schools to have this money and we want the students to benefit. But also my property taxes are going to go up and I'm already on a fixed income. I'm already on disability or whatever their reasoning was. But they seemed torn about what to do and how to solve the problem of the district needing the money.
Right. And this is one of those things when you look at the numbers, what is it going to mean for a typical homeowner in Milwaukee? Well, let's just say your home is valued, assessed at $200,000. I think the median home value in Milwaukee is about $188,000, $185,000, but let's just go to 200. It's easier for the math. We're journalists. Yeah. We always talk about, we want to keep the math as easy as possible. So I think for a person whose home is assessed at $200,000 in Milwaukee, you're going to see about $400 more in taxes and property taxes a year.
And that's a lot for
You think about that's $432 extra dollars per year over the next 10 years. That's $4,000 more dollars that are coming out of your pocket and out of your Social Security or whatever it may be. And I really think about that stacked on top of the fact that you've got that new 2% sales tax. Mm-hmm. You've got that new the county sales tax. Mm-hmm. You've got inflation. Well, someone who is struggling to get by, the groceries are more expensive. We now have a new city sales tax, a county sales tax, and $250 million being added to the MPS roles. So there is a lot that's adding up for taxpayers. And certainly at a certain point, that does become hard to manage for some, right?
That's right. And we know looking at data from Milwaukee, the number of people, the percentage of people that are what's called rent burdened. What is this concept that economists will talk about is 30%, that you shouldn't spend more than 30% on your housing costs. So that's just kind of the gold standard for when you're talking about budgeting. Economists and the federal government even will say, you know, spend up to 30% of your income on housing. That's about it. But if you go over that percentage, 30% or higher, then you're considered what's considered rent burdened or cost burdened is what the federal government calls it now. And 50% of Milwaukee is at that threshold of being rent burdened. The renters in Milwaukee, 50% of them in Milwaukee are rent burdened, meaning they're not able to necessarily meet what the ideal is for budgeting here. And that means a lot of troubles for trying to make ends meet. And now you're adding on property taxes. These property taxes will be charged to homeowners, but the homeowners, if you're a renter, the property owner is going to be passing these costs on.
An important point because for a lot of people who go, well, okay, but I don't own a $200,000 home, I rent. Well, your landlord owns that home. And if your landlord owns a bunch of homes, now that's magnified for them. Yep. They're not going to just absorb that cost. Right. They have their own margins. They're going to adjust the rent if the market calls for it and if they have to do that. So in the end, renters may feel this pinch as well.
Well, we talked to last night a little bit and I just can't remember if it was the three of you or if one of the experts, but like that this was an issue that likely drew a lot of voters from Milwaukee, that maybe, you know, the weather was a little crummy and maybe the other races maybe didn't interest them, but this was one that people would have done the research for or read up on it and then gone to vote simply for this referendum.
I think it's really also interesting when it comes down to a 51% vote. You talked about the people being on the fence. The vote really reflects that, right? I mean, this was a city on the fence.
It was. And what's interesting, you know, we talked about some of the criticisms of the referendum, you know, as far as the supporters of it, the teachers union and MPS talked about a $200 million budget deficit and that without this extra money coming in, they were going to have to make about 13% cuts to schools across the entire district. And that means potentially, they said, cutting those new positions they added after the 2020 referendum and art and music teachers that they added across the district. So these are the things that they said they needed that money immediately to make sure that in November, or I'm sorry, actually in August, when you start the school year, that money, or September, that money's there to keep these teachers on board. So that's what we're going to be looking at to see exactly how they plan for this and in their budgeting, which took place in January. Some of the things they're talking about is using this, the cost of inflation. They mentioned that the state hadn't been keeping up with inflation. And so they said if the state would have kept up with inflation, then maybe they wouldn't have needed this money. A lot of the Democratic lawmakers in Milwaukee blamed the Republican legislature. Republicans were saying, well, MPS just is not doing well in performance, and that
They would say you just throwing money at the problem isn't going to make student performance better. Right?
Yeah, and that's one of the criticisms from the GMC, the Greater Milwaukee Committee, was they wanted to see a plan for how you're going to improve learning outcomes, because when you look at it, the number of people that are proficient in reading and math in the district is very low. I can get those numbers in a second.
Isn't enrollment down too?
Enrollment's down significantly. Yeah.
In the last decade, enrollment's down about 20%. So when you're talking about the law, they talk about losing funding over the years. Well, part of that funding is because they've lost 20% of their student body over
the course
of
that. In fairness, I believe the teaching force is also down too, though, right? It's not as though they've kept the same number of teachers at the time that that student enrollment has gone down. I do believe that the workforce has also shrunk. If I've done my research on that right, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that sounds right, and that's one of the issues that Wisconsin Policy Forum, when they did a review of the finances for Milwaukee Public School and looking at this particular referendum, they said that there was a percentage of faculty that the district never hired on that they were supposed to after that 2020 referendum, and so they still haven't filled all those positions, and so there's a question about the budget shortfall and budget deficit based on MPS's calculations are that they're going to fill those positions, so therefore they need this extra money, and that's something that we'll see how they do. And one of the points that the teachers union made about why they needed this extra money for boosting salaries, giving pay raises to the teachers and other faculty, is to make it competitive, because there is a teacher shortage. We've seen that over the entire country where districts are struggling to hire on teachers. And so MPS, the teachers union as well, mentions that they need these pay raises to keep people on board and also to recruit new talent. We'll see how it actually works.
Specialty roles too, like you mentioned, the music, the art, the, a drama teacher, stuff like that. So those are all important roles too.
What's one thing I want to talk about here before we move on to some of the other things is this is another case. And for those who either are conspiracy theorists or those who have legitimate concerns about election integrity, here's another example where absentee ballots come into the last minute and swing an election from one result to another. And it's not to say there's anything nefarious about that, but it happened again. In this case, I think it's a little bit different from, say, a gubernatorial race or a presidential race, because when it's Milwaukee, you understand that Milwaukee votes in a governor's race or a presidential race are going to lean heavily Democratic. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when those absentee ballots come in, they are naturally going to swing. Here, I think it's interesting. These are votes within the city of Milwaukee that were going one way, although very narrowly toward the nose. Mm-hmm. Those absentee ballots come in late and dramatically swing it the other way. For those who are prone to conspiracies, you've got the people out there going, there go the absentee ballots again. And I think it raises that question again of how absentee ballots are counted and why they come in so late in the city of Milwaukee. There have been efforts by some in Milwaukee to say, give us the resources and the legal authority to do this so that we can get these done more quickly, so we don't have this late night swing. Conservatives have actually blocked that, right, Jason?
That's right. So, well, it's a complicated issue, but what happened was, just to lay out the law right now as it stands in Wisconsin right now, those absentee ballots cannot be counted. They can't even be processed until the polls open on election day. So we're talking about 7 a.m. on election day. That's when clerks can start processing absentee ballots. What does that mean to process an absentee ballot? Well, it means opening up the envelope. First of all, making sure there's the signature of the voter, the addresses are there. There's also the requirement to have a witness in his or her address there as well. So the clerks, the two poll workers, are going to review that absentee ballot envelope. They're going to make sure everything's good with that. And then they're going to finally open up the envelope. Of course, it's folded up, so it needs to be smoothed opened up, and then finally put through a machine. So that takes longer.
It's putsy, right?
It takes a little bit longer.
It's not just a pile of papers that they shove through a feeder.
Right. It takes longer than just when you're at your polling place and it just goes right through the machine quickly.
Yeah. But this plays into those who have that sort of fear that something nefarious is happening, right? Even if nothing nefarious is happening, when these votes come in late, people go, see? And I saw plenty of tweets from people saying, there was a late arriving USPS truck that had some ballots, and there they go again, coming up with ballots. Well, in reality, it was USPS who delivers these ballots every election, and they delivered 150 ballots that still had to be counted. The vote was a 1,700 vote margin. That didn't swing the election, whatever was in those 150. Right. But these late arriving things still play into those people who have a lack of trust for the system. Am I right?
Right. And there was a push in Madison through the assembly, but it didn't pass. It didn't move forward in the state Senate, but the assembly moved forward with a bill that would allow for the processing of these absentee ballots the day before, on the Monday before election day. We're one of the states, again, that doesn't allow that right now. There was a move in Madison, a bipartisan effort to get that through the legislature, but it didn't. So right now, the status of the law in Wisconsin is that no processing of absentee ballots before 7 o'clock when polls open. So what's going on here? Also, when you look at least at the polls in 2020, when we looked at, are you going to vote absentee? This is the pandemic, remember. Are you going to vote absentee? Or are you going to vote in person? The polls suggested that the overwhelming number of people that were going to vote in absentee were Democrat leaning to the left, right? So you can imagine that that has still continued on here to 2024, where you might have more of a percentage of the liberal voters just based on this.
Well, and I wondered, okay, it's like this, was there a push among maybe the teachers union to say, get out and vote absentee, get out and vote early, make sure we kind of put as many votes in the bank as we can. Maybe there's more organization behind the pro effort in this case to get that out. Certainly, whatever it was, there was a big swing in those. We have so much more to talk about from this election. And so we're going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk about a pair of constitutional amendments passed by voters in Wisconsin and what that means for upcoming elections. We'll do that right after this. So a pair of constitutional amendments were passed by voters, and this is change in the state of Wisconsin constitution. So this isn't just a law. This is the state constitution. Both of these have to do with election administration, how elections are operated in Wisconsin. Both were supported by conservatives in the legislature and even President Trump, who spoke about them, mentioned them when he appeared in Green Bay on Tuesday evening. So, Jason, what do these constitutional amendments do? And how will they change the way elections are operated in Wisconsin? Or will they just prevent them from changing in ways that maybe Republicans were concerned about?
No, it will definitely change. I mean, it changes the Constitution. So this enshrines what we're going to talk about here into the state constitution. Now, of course, there's this whole process right now where the votes need to be certified at the
These are unofficial results.
Unofficial results, but pretty much once this gets certified and becomes the law of the land, it'll be added to the Constitution. You had the final say. That's how constitutional amendments work in Wisconsin. The legislature passes it over the course of two legislative sessions, and then the final say is your vote, a referendum of the state. You approved both these constitutional amendments last night, so the changes the Constitution. First question was dealing with grants, election grants. Okay, what happened was in 2020, we saw there was this pandemic and we saw outside money, outside nonprofit groups donating, giving grants to cities across Wisconsin so that they could administer the election in the midst of a pandemic. What we saw that money coming from was a group called the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which happened to be funded. One of their major funders was Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. And so this money went to more than 200 communities across Wisconsin, applied for and received these grants. Of course, the five largest cities also received the majority of the money because they're the five largest cities. And those are Democratic strongholds of Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Racine, Kenosha, the cities.
And so when President Trump speaks in Green Bay yesterday, he says he implored voters who at his rally, get out there and vote. Tell me you're going to vote. Those are bad Zuckerbucks.
Yeah.
Bad Zuckerbucks. That's what he said.
And the Zuckerbucks refers to Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook's founder, who donated to this group that then donated to communities across the state. Now, long story short is conservatives just took offense to this money being used in elections. They thought that it's a liberal leaning folks were donating. What the money was used for in Milwaukee was they bought absentee ballot drop boxes in communities across the state. There were things like plexiglass dividers that were bought during the voting during the pandemic, sanitizer, other things. But conservatives took offense at this money and raised issues about it. And so they tried to pass laws the normal way, but there's the governor who's a Democrat who voted and vetoed these sorts of bills on elections. So they did the other power that they had was to try to go through the constitutional amendment process, and this did pass. So that was question number one on the grants. This will ban moving forward outside groups, nonprofit groups from donating to any election clerk.
Got to come from the taxpayer, right?
Yeah, it's got to come from the taxpayer. Can't through these outside groups can no longer help fund the elections. Now, when we heard from people on both sides, for example, the League of Women Voters, they they said that, you know, for years and years, communities have been using money, these grants like these, to help them to administer the election. And one of the things that that they said was that, this is the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin, they said that the state and the federal government just were not funding enough to help these clerks do what they need to do. So yeah, for years and years, they've been going out to outside groups to help them. Republicans, in opposition to this money, would raise various issues and say, for example, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is a conservative law firm here in Wisconsin, they would think, you know, we think private funding of elections should be of concern to people in either party. Take your biggest right-wing boogeyman, take someone like the Koch brothers. We don't think folks on the left would like them to be funding elections in conservative areas. So again, a lot of the money, the majority of the money, was spent in these Democratic cities, which raised questions for Republicans. And
but going forward, they won't be able to accept this outside money. So now it's got to be what comes from the taxpayer. The burden's going to be, I guess, on the government now, on the legislature and the governor, to make sure that these elections are properly funded.
That's right. Yeah. And so, but it's kind of interesting what happened in Milwaukee was, knowing that this was on the horizon, that this constitutional amendment was going to be voted on April 2nd, this week, they went forward with trying to accept a grant, and they did accept a grant from an outside group. I'm trying to find the.
You're going through these pages. Jason has so many notes on these elections.
But pretty much Milwaukee's Election Commission accepted a grant of $786,000. They wanted to accept that money, and then they had to use it because the state constitutional amendment, once it's actually in force, will say you can't accept money from outside groups. You can't spend the money.
So they had to not only approve it, they had to spend it quickly.
Right. And so what is the money going to? $786,000, a lot of money. $300,000 will be spent for two high speed tabulators. Those are the things that count the ballots. They just, if you've ever seen them, the ballots just go, I mean, they just fly through those things. So this will be used to count ballots on election day. And, you know, again, maybe that'll help with that problem we were talking about earlier.
The absentees, getting them counted more quickly. Yeah.
So that's part one, is the, you know, $300,000 for high speed tabulators. They're also spending $211,000 on 50 voting machines. This is touch screens. So they use them for early voting, because what it does is you use the computer, you touch screen who you want to vote for, and then it prints out your ballot. It's also used for people with disabilities.
Sure.
We had one lady who didn't have use of her hands, but she was able to put a pen or a pencil in her mouth and was able to vote with her mouth on the touchscreen, as opposed to she couldn't draw a circle, but she could touch with her with this tool used in her mouth. So that's going to be used in the city of Milwaukee. They're going to also be buying cell phones for poll workers to be able to contact the central office, as well as take photos if there's any problems at the polling place. They can also use it to access internet, to go on the Wisconsin voters page to find out, hey, you're at the wrong polling place. Let me tell you, let's look up on this website. Okay, you need to go to the other high school down the road.
Now, I know there's one other one. Talk about the second one, but we've got a lot of other races we want to get to. What's the second question? Because it is also related to election administration. This doesn't have to do with grant money. This has to do with people, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, so the second question deals with people. And really what it does is it confirms and puts into the Constitution what's already state protections, which is who's in charge of administering elections: election clerks, poll workers. Poll workers are the officially people that are running and administering all the elections in the state of Wisconsin. So this puts into the Constitution what is already the law of the land.
Does this prevent, is the concern here, was the concern among conservatives that some of these outside groups that are helping were actually helping to potentially even, you know, gather up some of these, maybe the drop boxes and deliver ballots and things like that? Is that the fear in the reason for this?
So it comes from a situation in 2020 where we had some open record emails that were showing what was going on with some of these outside groups and election clerks in Green Bay and Milwaukee. And what we saw was, in Green Bay, there was a person by the name of Michael Spitzer Rubenstein, and he was from a group, an outside group that the city of Green Bay had hired on as a consultant to work with them. But he was also from this outside group called National Vote at Home Institute. And in the emails, we saw him, for example, on October 7th of 2020, that's before Election Day in Green Bay, he's writing Green Bay's clerk, and he says, quote, and this is from the open records, this is what was in the documentation, quote, can we help with the curing of the absentee ballots that are missing a signature or witness signature address? We have a process map that we've worked out with Milwaukee for their process. Curing of absentee ballots is this process where the absentee ballot envelope, if it had missing a zip code or maybe it missed the street address for a witness, the clerks, if they can find out the information of where the zip code is or what the full street name is, they could add it. That was curing of absentee ballots. That was a process.
So this is an outside group saying, can we help with curing these ballots? And Republicans are going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Mm-hmm. And somebody else shouldn't be doing that. That's the election official's job, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there was another one email where the same Spitzer Rubenstein gentleman was talking about how they helped Milwaukee. And he said in one message, quote, I'm helping Milwaukee assign inspectors to central count stations as well as polling places. And another, he attached a document that he'd worked on called Central Count Procedures, and he wrote in a note, here's what we help Milwaukee create. So they're serving as consultants, they're helping, but if you look at the track record, some of these folks, they definitely were coming from a liberal perspective that raised alarm bells for conservatives, like, why are these people helping with elections? Now, it's very important to say Milwaukee's election director, Claire Woodall, at the time told me, quote, I remained in control of all election administration decisions and functions for the city of Milwaukee since July. So long story short, she said, I was always in control of the election ballots. These people did not have access to that. They were giving consultation and helping draft a document like, here's Central Count Procedure Manual and stuff like that.
All right. So these two things both pass, which means conservatives got what they wanted out of them. They are now in the Constitution. There was so much more on the ballot and the down ballot races. There was a lot to talk about. And one of the big things, of course, we've talked about, Sarah, is school referendums. So many of them, not just Milwaukee public schools, but there were in Southeast Wisconsin alone, I think 25 school referendums, more than $580 million worth of potential taxes on the table. And as I was doing count before we came on to record this podcast, I believe 16 of them passed.
Yeah.
So 16 out of 25, that's about a 66% rate. I'm doing a real quick rough math in my head. So 2/3 of them passed. That is better than things went for school referendums in February. Mm-hmm. It's not quite the 80 to 90% we were seeing back in 2018 and 2020, but overall, a fairly good success rate for school referendums statewide. Obviously, that's not much solace to those who are supporters of, for instance, the $102 million in Mequonago, which was shot down.
Yeah, it was shot down.
And that's obviously a very significant one. That was not an operating referendum. That was for new schools. Is that right, Jason?
Yeah, so that was the Mequonago Area School District. What they were going to do with that $102 million was they were going to build a brand new, they were going to tear down the current middle school, which is, you know, old. We had in our story, you can see they're bustling. Yeah, pretty much that area is, it's got a lot of development. They're growing. I think somebody at this.
Well, I may or may not be an MHS grad, but it's true.
But it's growing.
Mequonago draws from several communities. Mm-hmm. And so when I graduated, there were 560 in my class alone. And they've already done an expansion on the high school, you know, huge expansion. I know that it just continues to grow because they're drawing in from Vernon, Big Bend, sometimes Eagle. You know, if they're not going to Palmyra Eagle. So there's a lot of area communities that come into Mequonago School District.
It's also, it draws from a conservative area of the state where supporting big tax increases is a challenge. Yep. And in this case, obviously, they did not succeed.
And they're also not only, you know, bustling at the seams, you know, at the middle school. And did you go to the middle school?
No,
okay.
I went.
Okay. Well, that's okay. Sorry to put you on the spot here with that. But the middle school, I mean, the hallways have always been pretty much crammed with people, but the classrooms now are crammed with people, and they're expecting, you've got all these developments going up in that area of Mequonago, and they're expecting in like the next decade to have, I don't know, 300 more students in the district. So they're looking to have more space for those influx of people that are moving to that particular area. And they also wanted to then build this new middle school that would allow them to move sixth graders into that new middle school, which would then give the elementary schools in the district more room for four-year-olds, because right now there's a waiting list of 75 kids to get into 4K in Mequonago. And so they wanted to have more room for the 4K. They wanted to move sixth grade up to a brand new middle school. But the voters said, Nope.
Back to square one for them on those plans. Now, real quickly, I'll mention, of course, we have Milwaukee Mayor Cavalier Johnson elected to his first full term. You have a new Kenosha mayor. Tell us a little bit about that, Jason.
Yeah, so the new Kenosha mayor, that was an interesting race. Do you have the results there on your screen?
I can in a second.
The Kenosha mayor, we've only had, this will be the third new mayor in Kenosha since 1992. So you see these city mayors last a long, could potentially hold the position for a very long time. They, you know, the word they use is mayor for life. But the Kenosha mayor race, 53% voted for David Begdala, who right now is an alderman in Kenosha. He's been an alderman for 16 years there, and he works for Abbott. That's that medical company down there. Well, it's a national company, but he works for Abbott in that particular region. And he's been on the Common Council for a while. He beat Lydia Spotswood, who, if you don't remember, she ran against Paul Ryan when Paul Ryan was his first time running for Congress. He won. He went to Congress, later became Speaker of the House. And she ran for Kenosha mayor just yesterday and lost. She only got 47% of the vote there.
Would have certainly been the first female mayor in Kenosha's history.
Mm-hmm. First female to ever, she said, to even, you know, be on the ballot for mayor. One thing that was interesting about that particular race in Kenosha was to see who was endorsing both candidates. We saw with David Begdala, he was backed by the police union. And then we saw with Lydia Spotswood, she was backed by the Kenosha County Democrats. So you can read into that a few things about potential stances of both of those candidates, but I guess you could say the more, you know, I guess in the more political spectrum, you know, the Democrats were backing Spotswood and the police union, which police unions tend to be more on the conservative side, backed Begdala.
A couple more quick things before we move on to our last segment here and talk about the presidential primary race. But we had non-school referendums, and I look at Ozaukee County in particular, where there were 6 fire and EMS referendums, and every single one of them passed. And that will significantly change the sort of professionalism of those fire departments, because there are a lot of full-time firefighters that will now be hired. Among the 6 departments, and I guess it's actually going to be fewer than that because Grafton and Saukville will be consolidating, but among the 6 communities rather served by these departments, 33 new full-time firefighters and or deputy chiefs and chiefs, where these are communities that have primarily been volunteers or paid on call. And now you're going to have a lot of full-time firefighters in those communities. So it will significantly change fire and EMS service in Ozaukee County.
But here's the thing. When you look at Ozaukee County, like there was communities across the Ozaukee County voting for fire funding last night, or this week, I should say. And the question was, well, what's going on with Ozaukee County? Why are they the ones that are going to referendum on fire and EMS? Well, back in 2021, there was a Wisconsin Policy Forum report on Ozaukee County firefighting and the capacity for firefighting and EMS services in that particular county. And they found that it was really comparatively bare-boned and they had an inexpensive approach. Like you mentioned, there was a lot of reliance on volunteers. But at the same time, this area Ozaukee County is growing and growing and growing. And so when we talked with the fire chief in Cedarburg, he said calls for help, 911 calls, were up 47% in that community that had been relying on all volunteers. Well, if you're relying on volunteers, the way that works is, you know, is it a pager or phone? I think it's a pager.
It was a pager until recently. Yeah.
The pager would go off. There's an emergency and you're in the city. Okay, I'm going to hop in my car and go help out.
Yeah, so you've got to get from wherever you are to the station, get geared up, get in a truck or an ambulance and then head to the scene. So certainly, and that's just, can you find the volunteers willing to do that?
Right. And especially now that the call volume was becoming higher and higher and higher, and you're at that in Cedarburg up until this year, they were not getting paid for this. At one point, you know, people are just saying, I can't do this anymore. I signed up to be a volunteer. I want to do my duty, but I can't be responding to a 47% increase in calls. So that's one of the reasons why Cedarburg, both the city there and the town went to referendum, and it was $2 million every year added on to your
$5 million for all of those 6 communities that did this. And they all said yes. So that's obviously a significant change. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk about the presidential primary. It was sort of anticlimactic because we knew the candidates were going to be or who the nominees are going to be. But what we learned from yesterday's or from Tuesday's vote, we'll talk about that when we come right back. Oh, yeah, there was a presidential primary, too, right? So what do we make of those results? If you look at the numbers, the President Trump gets 79% of the Republican vote, but 21% of the people who came out for the GOP voted for somebody else. And similarly, on the Democratic side, President Biden, 89% of the Democrats in Wisconsin voted for him, who voted on Tuesday, but 11% voted for others. In fact, 8% of them said anyone other than Joe Biden, yeah. Uninstructed delegates were selected. So what do we take away from that, Jason?
I mean, it's a big deal for both sides. I mean, it's definitely both sides have to worry about how are they going to get those voters. Somebody checked the mark. They were going to vote in the Democratic primary. They're going to vote in the Republican primary, and they decided not to vote for the presumptive nominee. The question is, are those people going to come back home to their political party for the fall? The other question that Ted Perry had for me last night was, how many people are doing shenanigans with their votes where they're crossing? Because we have an open primary, which means you don't have to be, we don't register as a member of the party to get your absentee.
So how many Democrats voted for Nikki Haley, for instance?
Or the other way around, how many Republicans voted unobstructed or for Dean Phillips? We don't know. If you're one of those folks, you can give me a call. But I did hear from, I'm just going to give a couple of personal examples of what I heard anecdotally. One person admitted to me that they crossed parties last night to vote against the presumptive nominee of the opposing party just to kind of stick it to them. And I know of some Republican voters who didn't vote for Donald Trump, but will in the fall, but they wanted to, this is their one opportunity to sort of say they would like to see a different direction for the party. So at the end of the day, these unobstructed or uninstructed voters in the Democratic primary, there were 42,000 of them who were uninstructed.
It's a protest vote.
It's a protest vote. And we did have an organized movement in Wisconsin following in the heels of what we saw in Michigan, where 100,000 people voted. They have another term for uninstructed voters there, but pretty much the same concept in Michigan. They're actually going to get two delegates in Michigan. In Wisconsin, these uninstructed delegation, they're not going to
enough for the threshold.
They had to get to the 15% threshold to receive a delegate. So the Wisconsin uninstructed, they had their protest day. Now, what happens next? Are they going to come home and vote for Joe Biden in the fall? Or is this issue? I mean, what happened with this organized movement to vote that way was people on the left of the party, the liberal side, who were very upset over Gaza, Israel, and wanted to have their voice heard at the ballot box, voted uninstructed. 42,000. Now, that number is very important because when you look at the margins in the state of Wisconsin of who wins the state, President Joe Biden won Wisconsin by 20,000 votes. So this uninstructed delegation is double what the margin of his victory was in the state. That is a worrying sign for him. Are those people going to come home and vote for him, or are they going to cost him the election in the fall? That is something that we're going to be monitoring over the course of the next few
weeks. I think this is interesting, though. If you just break it down, Republican votes versus Democratic votes on Tuesday, 586,000 Republicans cast ballots in the Republican primary, or 586,000 people, whether or not they're actually Republicans, 572,000 Democrats, a very thin margin of 14,000 votes. So once again, even though you can't read too much into this for what's going to happen in November, it's another example of nearly identical numbers between the two parties, something we're getting awfully used to here in Wisconsin.
Yeah. And we don't read too much into an April presidential primary because you saw 1.1 million people. I said 1,000. I need some coffee.
So do I.
1.1 million people voted in the primary last night. We're going to see more than 3 million. So you're going to see more than doubling of people vote in the fall. So, you can't read too much into the select group of people that are really more interested in politics voting right now in the primary.
Except that it's another example of how the margins matter in Wisconsin. And it's why President Trump was in Green Bay. It's why we're going to see a lot more of Joe Biden. And we're going to see the running mates here as well. We're going to be seeing a lot happen. Obviously, the Republican National Convention is coming in July. So ground zero for politics, for presidential politics, state of Wisconsin, obviously, over the next many months. We are going to take one more break. And when we do, we're going to come back and go off the record. And it is time for us to go off the record. This is the part of the podcast where we get a little more casual and have a little fun by answering a question for which we have not prepared. And as Jason pointed out, it used to be that we used to open an envelope. And when you weren't here last week, I got to do that. It is nice to sort of have the reveal of the, it's like Johnny Carson doing that.
If you want, I can put the question in the envelope. And
but you know what? Go ahead. Ask us what it's going to be.
All right.
It's fine.
The rest of your life, let's think about that for a second. You only get to eat one dessert for the rest of your life. There isn't a whole menu. You don't get to pick whatever you want. One dessert forever and ever. Amen.
Easy answer.
Okay.
It's ice cream.
Okay.
It's do you have to pick a flavor or could it be any flavor?
Let's narrow it in.
No.
You got to pick a flavor.
This isn't your question, okay. Jason.
Pick a flavor, Jason.
Yeah.
Commit. Come on.
Commit. Yeah.
I love caramel and ice cream. So what are the, there's like the mousse tracks, but not mousse track.
Pralines and
cream. Definitely that would be top of the list.
Are you a dish or a cone?
I prefer the dish. The cone, it's like the bun on the hot dog.
It's like celery.
A good waffle or sugar cone. I'm not a cake cone person, but a good sugar cone. Oh, I think that's,
Okay, Brian.
But as much as I like ice cream, and I do, when I have ice cream, even though I like a lot of different kinds, like the flavors are good, I always end up gravitating to something with like mousse tracks or lots of fudge and chunks, which takes me to where I'm actually to go. Brownies with like heavy, thick, dense brownies with nuts.
Nuts. Why are you going to ruin them with nuts?
For me, that's – and a good chocolate icing on top.
Ooh, okay.
If I had to pick one, that would probably be it. The only thing that might rival it would be – pecan pie with Cool Whip on top. Good
pecan pies are good.
Heavy brown sugar pecan pie. Oh man. So that would be probably the toughest choice between the two, but because I love the chocolate, I think I'm sticking with the brownie.
Okay. I thought just a classic warm chocolate chip cookie. That's it. That's all I want. Make it warm.
Good, rich, melty chocolate chips.
Kind of out of the oven, but not too much that you're going to burn your mouth. But like 5 minutes out of the oven. That's.
Is there a way that they could make cookies where they're always like they're just out of the oven? Because that's the only way. And the chewy is not the same.
No, it's not the same.
No, not at all.
There's some chain cookie chains out there that serve just hot cookies and tend to be on college campuses and they tend to be up open very late and they're awesome. And
I think if you ask people in Milwaukee, what do they miss most when it comes to flying?
Midwest
Airlines or Midwest Express, the chocolate chip cookies. It's amazing how much that matters.
In high school, so you could buy things, you could go through the regular hot lunch line and then there was like a la carte. And one of the things they had were these two stacked chocolate chip cookies and they were like par baked at best. I'm surprised no one got sick from salmonella because they were like so almost like raw in the middle, but they were 50 cents and they were so good.
Can I just ask one thing? Because I think what goes best with a warm chocolate chip cookie?
Ice cream.
No. Well, milk. That too. But how about
thermos milk. Of milk?
No. Well, does anyone have any nearby?
I have a thermos of milk. Yes. It's I think 16 ounces of.
Is it warm or is it cold?
It's cold.
Oh, that's why I thought you were going to say warm and I was like, shut it down.
But would you be surprised that knowing that I have a thermos of milk for 2 days in a row that my choice was ice cream?
You like dairy.
And I changed my guy. I changed my one ice cream because I only get one custard flavor. I think I'm going to go with butter pecan. I mean, you mentioned pecan.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, pie and all that. I mean,
it's your answer.
No, but I think I want to change
question.
It.
It's my question. Your
butter pecan's fine if you're old.
The best answer is if we combine them, right? So like I put my ice cream on your
brownie. Oh, yeah, and then your absolutely. Cookie. That all sounds good.
And then
we all drink out of his thermos.
We're not doing that. Kale,
you forgot. We forgot about Cops. Hot fudge sundae.
Okay.
Their hot fudge, Cops' hot fudge is the best.
Okay. And, well, I don't know if I've ever had.
You've just reminded me I haven't made a trip to Cops in a while, so maybe that's going
to
be the next
one. And if I had to say one more, I would say Greeby's Crawler.
Oh! Ooh. Talking dirty now. Those Greeby's Crawlers are so
I know we're running
good.
Late. We got about another
Remember
minute
when I had
to talk
four
about
of them?
I want to ask this because donuts. Do you guys miss donut shops that had like racks and racks? Yeah. I feel like now there's nowhere that has
to the
these.
Grocery store.
Where's the best donut?
Well, wait a minute.
Place?
Are you kidding me?
There's honey
we have
dip donuts.
Yes.
Where's the nearest honey dip? I don't even know where that is.
I know there's one at like 60th and Forest Home.
There's Cranky Al's in Wauwatosa, which has really nice donuts.
I need to venture out further on Sunday morning to go find some good. Yes, because Ozaukee County is lacking in the donuts.
All right.
People, anyway.
We got to go.
They're going to call us and say we're the best donuts are in Ozaukee County.
I'll take a contact us. We're going to give you the email address in just a minute. We'll take one more break. We'll be right back. All right, that is going to wrap things up for this week. If you have a topic you would like us to discuss on Open Record or an issue you think we should investigate for Fox 6 News, send your emails to fox6investigators@fox.com. Sarah, thanks for being here.
No problem.
Jason, I know you've been working so
busy
much.
Man.
Elections are like your Super Bowl. Thanks for all the time you spent with us and the digital coverage in here on Open Record. As always, thank you to the people who make this podcast possible, including our executive producer, Sarah Smith, our editor, Dave Machuda, and our chief photographer manning the video switcher. That's Kale Zimney. With that, I'm Brian Polson. We'll be back next week.